Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
Today we're talking about something a little bit different from our usual fare, but I've been really fascinated over the last few days as we record this by the story of Julian Assange, who has been very unexpectedly released from prison and pleaded guilty to one charge of the US and is now back home in Australia, and kind of this very lengthy decade and a half long saga has come to a close. Have you been following the Assange story at all?
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? It's hard to remember all the details, so yeah. I'm pretty hazy on it all, but I understand that he got hold of a whole lot of confidential files and then made them available. Well, just remind us what the details of the story were.
Yeah, so it goes back to 2006 when Assange, who is a kind of Australian hacker libertarian figure, set up a website called WikiLeaks. And the premise is, like Wikipedia, it would be a kind of repository where anyone could secretly leak information of various kinds, and it would just be made available on the internet. And they had this kind of utopian idea, you know, information needs to be free. They had this kind of philosophy, and it wasn't necessarily initially directed at kind of a particular government or an issue. It was, you know, I think at one point they put up a whole bunch of personal records that someone got hold of, and there was kind of hard to see what exactly the kind of news interest was, but they just kind of thought that we should have more transparency in general.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's that very strong kind of hippie, you know, in the whole origin of Silicon Valley, the internet, you know, there was a strand which was very libertarian. Everything should be free, you know, no rules, open source. If you've got anything to hide, that's your trouble, you know. Basically, let's put
radical transparency.
But also, in retrospect, incredibly naive. And so there's always been that kind of uneasy link with other sources who are much more concerned about privacy, confidentiality, and all that.
Mm. Yeah, and so for a few years, WikiLeaks kind of is not very well known, and it does post some big kind of tranches of documents and files that it gets leaked to it. There's a brief flare up over some banking story, and the Swiss banking system briefly manages to get WikiLeaks taken offline, but then that's overturned and they're back online because they posted some banking files. But it all kind of kicks off around 2010, which is when WikiLeaks is leaked. A large trove of files from the US military by at then anonymous, but we now know it to be an American soldier called Chelsea Manning, who was later arrested and convicted and spent several years in jail. And she passed over the internet huge numbers, hundreds of millions of files that she worked as a kind of data analyst, I think somewhere in the US military, had surreptitiously downloaded from the government servers and passed them on. And they weren't mostly kind of like high tech, kind of top secret stuff. It was like lower level classified things. But the most famous thing was a video taken from a helicopter gunship. I think it was in Iraq. And it's a video from the eye line of the soldiers as they machine gun a group of Iraqis, killing 18 people, 18 civilians, including two foreign journalists as well, which was obviously a very shocking kind of revelation, being successfully covered up by the military until that point.
And was it ever clear what her motivation was?
It's a good question. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't looked into that side of the story in detail. I think she had some vague sense that the government was up to some shady things, and that she was across in her day-to-day work was coming across stuff that she thought should be out there. And I think potentially she had shared some of the kind of hacker ethos of WikiLeaks and Assange. So she gets in touch with Assange over the internet and says, look, I've got millions of files. Here they are. And Assange basically initially starts to work with some journalists at The Guardian or The Washington Post. But he also says, I'm also, as well as giving some of these files to you to publish stories on them, I'm also just going to take the entire trove, 500,000 files, and just dump them in a database, freely accessible data. It's on the internet for anyone to read. And then a few months later, he does a similar thing with some diplomatic cables. So these are messages that US diplomats are sending from their various embassies back to Washington, giving their kind of real unvarnished opinion and information about what is going on in these different countries. And these are also, again, just dumped in a big searchable database online in its entirety.
Had they come from the same source?
No, they came from another source. I can't recall exactly where he got hold of those. It may not even be clear. I think WikiLeaks was intended to work as a kind of invisible, anonymous middleman. So you could, in theory, give them files without revealing your identity through some kind of internet encryption.
And people had tried to persuade him not to do this. Is that right?
So a lot of the problem was that in both the diplomatic cables and the war files, they included lots of information, in particular that identified people in Afghanistan and Iraq who had worked for the US government and various had their names and their addresses. And clearly, it's highly dangerous for it to be known in Iraq, Afghanistan, both then and now, that you are kind of a collaborator with the hated Western occupying forces. So these people are put in massive danger. And journalists specifically told Assange, you need to redact their names if you're going to do this. You know, please don't just dump it all unedited. And he basically said, I don't care. They're informants. You know, if they get killed, it's their problem. They shouldn't have worked with America in the first place. And then even more so with the diplomatic cables, you know, often the diplomats were writing about meetings they had been having maybe with political dissidents, in that if you're the embassy to an authoritarian regime, part of your job is to build contacts with human rights activists and lawyers and dissidents and opposition politicians, sometimes religious leaders. And again, he just dumped those all unedited, unredacted for anyone to see. And so if you're a dictator, you can log in and find out very easily who the American diplomats have been in touch with. So again, putting these people at huge risk.
And is there evidence of that people came to harm as a result? I mean, is this again?
This is highly contested. He says, WikiLeaks say, no, this is all overblown fear mongering. The US authorities say, yes, some people did come to harm as a result. I haven't seen anything that kind of definitive says this individual was murdered and he was named in the files.
But, almost by definition, you know,
they're not going to highlight that, are they? So I can't say hand on heart for absolutely sure that Assange has blood on his hands and that, you know, people died as a result of this. But at the very least, it was widely seen as kind of highly irresponsible. So he then gets locked into a legal struggle where the US is threatening to charge him with espionage and, you know, publishing classified information. And while he's in the middle of this legal battle, he, out of the blue, is suddenly also charged or is wanted for questioning by police in Sweden, because it emerges that two women in Sweden have come forward to accuse him of rape and sexual assault. And as a result, an arrest warrant is issued for his arrest and extradition. And it was then in 2012 that he then flees into the Ecuadorian embassy in central London and is given political asylum in Ecuador. But obviously he can't get to Ecuador except by going back onto British territory, in where he will be arrested and sent to Sweden. And so he then spends the next 7 years hiding inside the very, apparently very pokey Ecuadorian embassy.
So this is something, in case people are not aware of this, but according to sort of very ancient legal statutes, once you're in an embassy, the physical area of that embassy belongs to the distant country. And
yes, little patch of Ecuador in central London.
The host has no rights in that little patch. Yes. That's Ecuador. Ecuador can do whatever it likes, even though it's actually, as you say, Ecuador in the middle of London.
Yeah, so the Met Police had officers stationed on the doorstep of the embassy. And if he ever set one foot back on British territory, they would have grabbed him, popped him on a plane and arrested him and extradited him off to Sweden. But as long as he remained inside the embassy, the police couldn't go and get him. It's, you know, one of the very few buildings the police are not allowed to barge in and grab someone, even if there is a legal warrant for their arrest.
And why Ecuador? Was it just he was passing the door and not looking for an embassy?
No. So at the time, the Ecuadorian president was a kind of leftist who was sympathetic to some of Assange's kind of anti-American, anti-Western ideology, and so saw him as a kind of persecuted freedom fighter. and so gave him political asylum there. So 7 years pass. The Swedes are still trying to get him out. He's saying, no, I won't go. He insists he's innocent. He insists he didn't commit these sexual assaults, but he says, I can't go to Sweden to fight the charges because it's actually a ruse and Sweden is being used as a ploy by America. And as soon as I go to Sweden, I'll then be sent off to America and get the death penalty for publishing these files. And so he hides out in the embassy for 7 long years. And then there is a change of government back in Ecuador. And a new president comes in who is not a fan of this incredibly irritating diplomatic headache. Apparently, but I should say, Assange is apparently not a very good guest and is constantly rude and demanding and takes lots of space. And the other diplomats in the embassy hate him, fed up with this squatter. And so in 2019, the new government in Ecuador revokes his diplomatic immunity and dumps him out on the street outside where the Met is waiting to pick him up. And then, but in the intervening time, he has successfully strung out the Swedish case so much that the charges are dropped in Sweden due to the statute of limitations. Mm. And so he's no longer wanted in Sweden for questioning. But he is there, but he is arrested in the UK for fleeing an arrest warrant and breaking his bail conditions.
So he's now in prison.
He's then imprisoned in Belmarsh Prison in London for 5 years. At which point America then applies to extradite him after he completes his UK sentence. And because he is a flight risk, he's not released from prison, but he then is stuck in a multi-legal year battling against extradition, and it goes up and down. It goes to the Supreme Court and Court of Appeal.
Americans are waiting at the prison gates saying he's going to be released from prison.
And then it's the British authorities would stick him on a plane and send him off to America, who would be waiting for him in JFK Airport or whatever, and put him on trial. And they have charged him with multiple counts of under the Espionage Act of conspiring to hack government computers and publish classified information. And there's a long battle. And then, just to bring you up to date, last week he was very suddenly came to a deal whereby he agreed to plead guilty to a single charge, and the sentence was agreed to be time served, the 5 years he spent in the UK prisons. And so then it was a done deal, and he was a free man, and he was then flown out of the UK back to Australia, where he is a citizen. So that is the kind of resolution of the long, very long Julian Assange saga.
So before we talk about the ethics of it and all this, the Americans basically gave up. They, because what do they get here? They get nothing.
The theory is that they get him to plead guilty, so he admits that he is a criminal. And his whole theory has been, I'm not a criminal, I'm a journalist, I'm a whistleblower, I'm an activist, I have done nothing wrong. I'm not a spy. This is a persecution of the press and of my First Amendment rights. But the Americans have got him to plead guilty, so he has admitted that he is a criminal and that what he did was wrong. And they've decided, rather than spend years more fighting him in the courts to get him to come to America, we could get this issue off our hands and move on. Mm. So yeah, it's a kind of both parties have had to lose something to save face. They can claim that they won. Assange can say that he's free. Everyone kind of, and the UK can get him off their territory finally 14 years later.
So as a journalist, what is your take on all this? I mean, you're interested in investigative journalism. You've done some investigative journalism yourself. What's your take on Assange?
Yeah, so Assange is a very kind of divisive figure, I would say, among journalists. You get some journalists who really buy into the kind of cult of Assange and believe that he is a journalist, one of us, unjustly persecuted and harassed for truth-telling, for revealing damaging but necessary secrets about the US government's illegal wars and their crimes against humanity and human rights violations. And, you know, he has been unfairly detained in the Ecuadorian embassy, self-detained, I suppose, for 7 years, and now in the UK prison for 5 years. And it's all a huge miscarriage of justice. And, you know, he's a hero who should be lauded. And I have to say, I've never really bought into that view, fundamentally because I don't agree that he's a journalist. I don't think what he did was journalism, nor was it particularly kind of intrinsically virtuous either. In fact, it was quite, as we mentioned earlier, irresponsible. And so I have never had an issue with the kind of the UK authorities, you know, who don't really have a dog in the fight. They're just trying to, you know, execute arrest warrants from other countries and extradition, legal extradition requests. And it is Assange, I believe, who's kind of, you know, detained himself in the embassy in a desperate attempt to avoid justice.
Okay, so he's not a journalist, but what's a journalist? I mean, yeah, this is protecting your professional privileges, isn't it? Like I say, well, he's not a doctor. He's not a proper doctor.
Yes, and unlike a doctor, there unfortunately isn't a special register, a degree qualification everyone has to have. You know, you don't have a general journalist council number to flourish to prove that you're a journalist. So yes, there is a question of semantics and definition. The reason I say I don't think he's a journalist, because simply taking information that is previously been secret and making it available is not the sole definition of journalism. What a journalist do, and what they did do in some of these stories with these files, is if you get hold of classified information, you believe it's in the public interest, you then write a story about it. You utilize that information, but you're very careful. So, you know, you think about the consequences of publishing that, because it has, you know, in this arena of national security, it generally has life or death. You know, when you publish secret classified information, you have to think, actually, is this in the public interest? It might be good for my sales of my newspaper or my hits to my website, but is it in the public interest? You know, you have to weigh up whether there are competing priorities here, there are risks and benefits. And you also, you know, you're going to check your facts with multiple sources. You're going to place this information in its proper context so that the non-expert readers coming across it can make sense of it. Whereas Assange doesn't do that. He just takes a big slab of information, which is secret, and says, boom, now it's public knowledge. I don't care about the consequences. I don't care. I haven't thought about the context. I haven't checked the facts. I haven't redacted names and edited things and weighed up risks and benefits. I've just plonked it on the internet and said, job done. And that, it just doesn't correspond to any of the kind of responsibility that journalistic ethics requires, which is why, yeah, I don't have very much sympathy for him.
Yeah, and so journalists have to live within the rule of law, and they've got to be aware of what the law says about security information. And or if they are going to break the law, and there have been cases, haven't there, when journalists have broken the law and been prepared to go to prison. You know, a court has asked them to reveal their sources and they've refused and taken the consequences.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that a deep-rooted kind of tradition of at least kind of journalism in the Western world that I was raised in, it is absolutely that there is sometimes you have a higher calling than simply to keep the law. So, you know, so you don't willy-nilly break the law, but sometimes your responsibility to the public, as we would conceive it, trumps your responsibility to do what you're told by a court. So, you know, it's never come to this, and for most journalists, it never will. But when I did my training as a journalist many moons ago, and we were learning about protection of sources, you know, there is, you're kind of told your job, your ethical responsibility as a journalist is that even if at the risk of going to prison, you are required to reveal information that was given to you confidentially, your job is to say no, is to break a court order, is to, if necessary, go and spend days, weeks, months in prison rather than reveal to the state, to the government, who your source is. So yes, there is a sense in which journalists need to be legally responsible and work within the rule of law. But no, I don't believe it is always wrong for journalists to break the law. But it's about how you break the law, and critically, for what reason. And in that instance, you're refusing a court order because you believe that the promise that you made to your source and the obligation you have to the public to facilitate that communication from the source to the public supersedes your duty to obey the government.
But part of the problem is this very vague phrase, the public interest, isn't it? Because often newspaper editors, you know, publishing the most salacious and titillating information about some public figure will argue, oh, yes, but it's in the public interest that people knew what that politician was doing in the toilet. And It's one of the interesting things, and you know, what does that mean? What is the public interest, and how do you define it? Was that something that you talk about in?
Absolutely, yeah. That's a massive part of how we understand what we do, and let's be clear, there is no kind of chiseled on stone tablets to define these things. These are ideas and traditions that have evolved over hundreds of years since we had a kind of free press here in the UK, at least, which I'm most familiar with. But there have been, and these are constantly contested, and two journalists will often disagree about what is or isn't in the public interest, but there are attempts to codify it. So the thing that you're taught here in the UK is called the Editor's Code of Practice, which is a kind of self-regulation. It's a voluntary code of conduct and ethics that the vast majority of news outlets are signed up to. It doesn't have any legal force. And it defines the public interest as, this public interest includes, but is not confined to, it is these things, but it can be something else. Detecting or exposing crime, the threat of crime or serious impropriety, protecting public health and safety, protecting the public from being misled by an individual or organization, disclosing a person or organization's failure to comply with any obligation to which they are subject, disclosing a miscarriage of justice, raising or contributing to a matter of public debate, including serious cases of impropriety, unethical conduct or incompetence, or disclosing concealment of any of the above. And they also say there is also a public interest in freedom of expression itself. So there is an attempt to kind of summarize what the public interest is, but it is, as you will see from the definition, a little vague, or at least open to interpretation. And that, I think, is probably unavoidable.
Yeah, but I must say that's quite impressive, as a definition, because each of those segments, phrases, you can see a real logic, a moral element to that, isn't it? There is real value to the body of citizens that they know these things. And it is interesting, isn't it, that a free press has always been seen as a really absolute essential bulwark for a democracy to function effectively. It's part of the essential framework for a democratic society, which, of course, has been under continual threat.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
But so where do whistleblowing, where does that come in?
Yes, because a lot of people would say, well, if Assange isn't a journalist, maybe he's a whistleblower and deserves protections on those grounds. So whistleblowing is, again, a slightly nebulous term, isn't it? But I think it's often understood to be an individual in an organization who comes across something in the course of their work which they believe is unethical or improper or unlawful or, you know, should be exposed, and then uses kind of private confidential information that they've obtained in the line of their work to blow the whistle, to tell the world about it. I would suggest that Chelsea Manning, the US soldier who leaked the information, is the whistleblower, and Assange was simply a kind of hacker dumper of information. But there's a question about the role of whistleblowing, and it's become increasingly prevalent here in the UK in recent years because we've had a series of scandals about public institutions which have been come out many years later. So we've had recently the infected blood scandal, which is about how people who were receiving blood transfusions and other blood products were carelessly and recklessly given blood that was infected with AIDS or HIV or hepatitis, and many of them died tragically. Then there was a cover-up. We've had the post office scandal about, the post office here maliciously kind of prosecuting postmasters and sending several to prison. Some even killed themselves over false accusations of stealing money, when actually it was the post office's own faulty computer system that was stirring up the wrong results. So there's been a lot of conversation about whistleblowing in general.
And in the health service, have there been... and in care homes, numerous examples, haven't there?
Prisons and detention centres, yeah.
And one of the recurring themes, you know, when you look at whistleblowing cases, is that sadly the whistleblower themselves is often motivated entirely by what appears to be positive motives. They're seeing something which they think is utterly appalling, and they are being prevented from, often management are telling them, you mustn't, you know, we are not going to do anything about this. You must keep it quiet, confidentiality, and so on. They feel they must go to the public, and often professionally and often personally, they suffer a great deal. Many of them never work again. They're labelled.
Blacklisted.
They're blacklisted. Some of them are prosecuted. Many of them suffer sort of hate speech and all the rest. And it's one of those paradoxes that these people who in many ways are genuine heroes or could be seen in some circumstances, I'm not saying about Chelsea Manning, but some of them could be seen as genuine heroes, suffer enormous personal consequences as a result, negative consequences.
And there's a really interesting, if kind of frustrating, struggle, I think, to build structures and institutions and systems whereby whistleblowing is encouraged. You know, so I think most large institutions are, I think they were actually required, certainly financial institutions are required to have whistleblowing policies. And, you know, if you're, I think large banks and things like that are, because of, again, a string of scandals and corruption, things like that, are required to have kind of phone lines and email addresses where an employee can anonymously report concerns. And similarly, the UK government has been trying for several years to make it easier for whistleblowers in the NHS to warn about, you know, poor quality of care and corners being cut and things like that. But it's very, very difficult to create the environment in which whistleblowing is encouraged, because basic human nature tells you that every institution will seek to protect its own interests. And so the Secretary of State for Health can bang on till he's blue in the face about how we want more NHS whistleblowers. But time and time again, and individual NHS trusts are continuing to retaliate and make it clear that whistleblowing is very much not welcome. And when someone does it, it, as you say, it often ends badly for them. So I think there is a real struggle. You know, we say on one level, as a society, we love whistleblowing. We want more of it. It contributes to justice and exposes injustice and corruption and mistakes. It protects the public. And yet time and time again, banks, schools, universities, hospitals, actually, when it comes to it, treat whistleblowers very badly.
Yeah. And so I suppose one possible solution to this is good investigative journalism that protects its sources. So if that was possible, you know, so here is, you know, I in my job within the NHS, I'm seeing something absolutely appalling. And I contact you and tell you the story and say, but I really don't want to be named and I want you to cover up my identity. Then you will now tell the story. And you're protected as an investigative journalist, and that's your job. And provided you protect your sources, I can continue to work within the NHS.
Yes, and that's the kind of theory about how it works, right? And that's where these taboos and conventions around the strictness with which journalists have it drummed into them, you never reveal the identity of your sources. The reason is because without that, no one will ever trust a journalist again, right? You know, so I, right now, as we record, have at least two or three ongoing kind of stories I'm exploring in which people have approached me and said, you know, there's something going on that's wrong and I want to tell the world about it, but nobody can know it was me. Nobody can know it was me. And, you know, and I say, of course, you know, if that I would honor and respect that. That's very important to me. But if I then sloppily or lazily or, you know, cynically betray these people and say, oh, yeah, it was Joe Bloggs told me about that church, which was doing X, Y and Z wrong.
You name the parish, you say, you know, a source within.
Yes.
Within,
or even we're talking about things. Yeah. But there's even a thing called like jigsaw identification, which is where you don't give their name, but you give enough pieces of the jigsaw that someone could say, okay, so it was a woman in her 40s who worked in this job between these years. Yeah. Only one person fits the bill. So you had to be careful. But if I was sloppy or betrayed a source, no one would ever approach me ever again, right? Because I would have a reputation as a journalist who can't be trusted. So on a practical term, it's necessary to do the job. But I think it also is kind of ethically responsible because it facilitates the kind of truth telling that we're looking for. So you know, there is a legitimate question about whether, to go back to Assange, whether he counts as a whistleblower. And I guess the reason I don't, and don't, again, don't lionize him as a kind of hero, unlike the people who blew the whistle on the post office scandal or the infected blood scandal, is because even though sometimes his information did reveal genuine injustice, like that horrifying video of the US soldiers shooting civilians and journalists in Iraq, it wasn't done responsibly, but it wasn't done impartially. So the key thing about Assange that's become clear over the years and WikiLeaks is that it is unlike a true news organization or a journalist. It has an axe to grind. It has goodies and baddies in its worldview. And this became particularly clear during the Hillary Clinton Democratic emails thing. I don't know if you remember that from 2016, which was that during the presidential election, Russian intelligence operatives hacked into the Democratic Party's system and stole a whole bunch of their emails and then gave them to WikiLeaks to publish, very intentionally and deliberately Putin's behest, to interfere with an enemy, as they saw it, the US kind of democratic system. And Assange was happy to do this and happy to work with the Russians because he doesn't like America. The fact that the Russian government is orders of magnitude more corrupt, more evil, does things that Washington would never even dream of, is beside the point to him, because in his worldview, America is the baddie and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I can guarantee you, if someone was to come saying to Julian Assange, I've got a trove of documents about the things that the Kremlin has been up to, he wouldn't publish it. And that is what distinguishes him from true journalists and even whistleblowing, is because his lodestar is not what is the public interest, what serves the common good. It is what attacks my enemies and protects my friends. And that is not the framework in which you can do responsible ethical journalism.
Yeah, well, very interesting. And I think one of my take-home messages from this conversation is that actually, you know, properly resourced investigative journalism is a very important feature of society, and it deserves to be recognised as such. And sadly, for whatever reason, often journalists do get a very bad press. You know, I remember that list where you have professions that can be trusted, and it puts nurses and doctors up at the top, and professors quite a long way down, I have to say, but journalists are definitely.
I think we're only more trusted than MPs and estate agents, I seem to recall.
So why is that? You know, we ought to close this.
Question.
You know, so here is this honourable profession, you know, knights in shining armor, dedicated to shine the truth into these dark places.
And the sunlight public... of disinfectant, you know.
Exactly. And the public say, you've got to be joking.
Yeah. I remember this very clearly, very painfully coming across in the early days of the lockdown when, do you remember when they were doing the daily press conferences? This is in the kind of first few weeks, and Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, would be appearing at the podium each day, telling us about the latest horrible figures and what the government was doing. And, you know, the press corps were arriving in Westminster and were kind of, you know, I would say, asking challenging, robust questions about why didn't the government better prepare for this? And, you know, isn't the lockdown totally incoherent? And why are you banning this but not that? And there was a lot of probing, trying to tease out contradictions and say, you know, basically hold power to account. And the overwhelming response of the public was, why are you attacking our politicians at a time of national crisis?
Yeah.
Get behind the government, pull in one, you know, what, you know, you've missed the public mood.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's infuriating as a journalist because you're like, but we're doing this for you. We're doing this on behalf of the public because we want you to have the best possible government looking after you at a time of crisis. But there is such deep loathing and mistrust of journalism that people, even as the journalists were trying to kind of, you know, hold the power to account on their behalf, they were despised by the people they were sent to be working for. So yes, there is a huge problem with the lack of trust in the media. You can't ignore the fact that a large part of that is because the media doesn't live up to those lofty ideals about the public interest we were talking about, that vast swathes of journalists actually publish information that isn't in the public interest and breach people's confidences and privacies and, you know, kind of sneering and salacious and intrusive and disrespectful, and publish vast swathes of irrelevant tittle-tattle that has no interest. You know, they would say they're giving people what they want, but fundamentally it does destroy trust in it as a kind of honourable profession.
Yeah, and I think also, as I'm just thinking about, there was just, I have personally, you know, been on the other end of a sudden journalistic mob who are taking words I've said and using them. And the one incident where it really happened, and there was a kind of mini feeding frenzy for a few hours, 48 hours, about me. I remember at the time feeling suddenly, it was absolutely terrifying, the power that these people had, that they could make banner headlines, they could say whatever they liked about me. You know, they could just, at a moment's notice, a television crew appears, you know, the power of the media, when you are the little guy and you suddenly feel the crosshairs have selected you and are going, and there was no feeling it, although in theory, you know, we just want to hear what you're saying, you know, the sense that this was a demolition job. For whatever reason, a lot of journalists had decided I was effectively misleading Parliament and telling porcupines, and therefore I had to be, you know, exposed to the most critical analysis. That is a very frightening position when you suddenly see the power of the media and the resources it has at its disposal to analyze you. So I think that has led me with a lasting mistrust, knowing that anything I say could be suddenly latched onto, turned around the other way and used to attack me.
Yeah. And I think that power word is vital in this conversation, because, and I think it's really important that journalists like me constantly reflect on the power that you hold in your hands. And how imbalanced it is, you know. Yeah, nobody exactly. was scrutinizing the journalists' words and picking over their messages and their tweets. Absolutely. And their histories. It was all one-sided. And, you know, I think there are reasons for that. But, like, fundamentally, I always think about it, like, journalists do hold an enormous power in their hands, and therefore they should hold it with kind of fear and trembling, because this is a weighty, weighty responsibility that we have been given or taken upon ourselves on behalf of wider society. It's incredibly imbalanced, as we say. And it needs, and that's why I say, as I said at the beginning, it needs to be held with responsibility. And that's why good journalism has built up a kind of code of ethics that helped guide you around what you're doing, and which Julian Assange, by the by, trampled over repeatedly. But also, I think it's why there needs to be real kind of caution and care taken. You know, and every time I click publish on a story or send off a copy, I should be thinking, you know, have I absolutely certain I've got my facts right? Am I being as fair and impartial as possible? Am I not allowing my own prejudices and opinions and bias to blind me to what's really going on? Am I simply seeking to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth as best I can? And constantly kind of questioning and challenging myself, because it is, you know, I know that, you know, it can be incredibly destructive, journalism. It can be quite exploitative, kind of rapacious, swoops into people's lives, sucks what it wants, and then moves on. It's yesterday's fish and chips. And that needs to be held very, very carefully by Christians. I guess the final thing I would say on this is I, because my job in particular is journalism about the church. And so when I do these kind of investigations and expose things, it's not just, you know, an NHS manager who's cocked up, it's a church leader or an institution or a denomination or a diocese. I do sometimes get kind of slightly raised eyebrows from other Christians saying, well, hold on, you know, how can you as a Christian be exposing God's church to all this scandal and disgrace? How, you know, wouldn't it be better if we could sort this out behind closed doors rather than hamper the mission of God's church by revealing what a bunch of
washing your dirty linen? Yeah, do we really want the world to know quite how corrupt our churches.
Exactly. And it's often not phrased in so stark terms, but I do have to spend a lot of time kind of defending the notion of robust scrutiny of Christians and the church themselves. And I don't know what you think. Do you share any of those concerns about the kind of validity of Christians exposing other Christians and their flaws?
No, I think I'm with you. Interestingly, I would justify it on a theological basis, and that is that it's a great theme throughout Scripture that the Lord looks on the heart and not on the outward appearance, and that authenticity is where there is a match between what's in the heart, the deepest intentions and purposes, and this and the external appearance. And you know, you think of Jesus and the Pharisees. You know, why was it that the Pharisees were subjected to such sustained attack from Jesus? It was because they were hypocrites, because the external, what they were claiming to do was miles away from their hearts or what was actually going on. And that's why I would argue that even the private lives of politicians is actually relevant, that the public does have, to some extent, the right to know. You know, if this person who is claiming to, you know, to want to lead us and make decisions on our behalf is actually known to be utterly unreliable in their private life, is known to be constantly breaking their promises and living in a way which abuses other people, it's not good enough to say, well, that's my private life. It's nothing to do with, I think a Christian vision would say, hang on a minute, you know, it matters. What's going on in the heart matters. And therefore, it is relevant. And the same applies to our Christian leaders. If it turns out that our Christian leaders are living lives of terrible hypocrisy, you know, that they're wolves in sheep's clothing, then that matters. We can't just say, well, it's not a very pretty spectacle, let's just turn aside. So I think it is a very salutary process, and again, we live in an era which is fascinated by the outward appearance and is fascinated by people who are attractive, gifted, and all the rest. And Christian thinking says, no, it's the heart. It's the character. It's the reality.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really strong point. All I would add is the other thing I often tell when people kind of challenge me on that is what else does our Christianity tell us? It tells us that all people are flawed and sinful and marred by sin. And the truth is these mistakes, these sins, they are happening. I know they're happening because people come and tell me about them, but we all know that they're happening. And so our options are either we try and deal with it internally or we expose it and we bring it to light. And the truth is churches don't deal with these things internally. They just don't, because they're run by flawed, just like those NHS managers who have whistleblowing policies and everything else. But when it comes to it, they don't encourage their employees. The churches are the same. They're run by the same flawed human beings. And so, you know, the reason I do my job is because I want a church to be better. I want it to be safer when it deals with vulnerable children. I want it to be better when it comes to handling money and power and sex and all these things. And the reason I am very confident and relaxed about the kind of ethicalness and even the Christianness of exposing these things is because I believe that as you reveal that this church failed that way and this leader betrayed people in that way, it's not just interesting and salacious to read, but it also inches us towards a church which is better and safer, and that the next generation of pastors and leaders are less likely to fall into these traps and sins. So actually the only way you get there is through the uncomfortable, painful winnowing process of bringing it to light.
Agreed. I would just want to add the counter thing, which is let him without sin cast the first stone. You know, that what journalists, as they attack hypocrisy elsewhere, must always be live to is the hypocrisy in their own lives. And therefore, if a journalist makes a mistake, they too should be the first to be exposed. Yeah. And to and to allow scrutiny of their own activities.
Yeah. You need the circular firing squad, the press training its guns on the other parts of the press. You know, I scrutinise you and you scrutinise me, right? Who watches the watchman?
The circular firing squad is not a good analogy. I think circular firing squads are a disaster.
Okay, a more positive version of a circular firing squad. But yes, you're absolutely right. The one thing, journalists do have a healthy streak of hypocrisy running through them, which is that they love to call out wrongdoing in others, and they're very, very slow to acknowledge it in themselves, or sometimes even to expose it among other journalists in this kind of, you know, the code kicks in, and that is wrong. And as you say, what is goose for the gander is sauce for the goose is sauce for the whatever that weird phrase is. Like, we have to be on the same page, you know. And so, yeah, I agree. There needs to be more healthy scrutiny of what the press are doing as one of the most powerful kind of institutions of the land, just as they are scrutinizing everyone else.
And exactly why the goose needed sauce and why the sauce that the gander was having is different. Why does the goose
need sauce? It's a very odd metaphor in many ways. It's no surprise it's falling into disuse. I doubt I'll try and use it again because I absolutely bungled it that time. Right. Well, before this descends into further chaos, let's draw it to a close there. Thanks, Dad. It was a little self-indulgent, but I hope it wasn't completely uninteresting to you and others listening in who don't have the fortune of taking up this great and honourable and noble profession of journalism. A quick reminder, if you'd like to follow some of my work, you can see my personal website, tswyatt.com. And you can also sign up to my Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend. Every week I send around some interesting news and analysis about what is going on in the church here in the UK and around the world. That's tswyatt.substack.com. You can reach us, molad@premier.org.uk. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you disagree? Do you hate all journalists and think that Christians should do the same? Please let us know. I'm a masochist. I'm happy to hear it.
If you can think of a substitute for our current host, you know, who wasn't a journalist, you know, by all
held means. Held a more Christian profession and industry and calling, let us know. But in all seriousness, we'd love to hear your thoughts and your comments on what we've been talking about, and also suggestions for things that we could cover in future episodes. We really enjoy picking up on some of those themes too. So email us, molad@premier.org.uk. And Dad's website, just to round us off, is johnwyatt.com. Nothing on journalism, but lots of other interesting things to read about. Ethics, science, technology, medicine, healthcare, the Bible, the church, and beyond. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.